Good afternoon. I have Mr. Bruno on the line. I have Ms. Rye on the line, and I have the University of Alabama on the line. Is that correct?
Yes, Tori is still here.
And I am here as well.
Hi, Jessica.
And good afternoon, Mr. Bruno, and good afternoon, Ms. Rye. This is Matthew Culver from Houndstooth and Hard Hats with the University of Alabama. On the line with me is Kara Parks.
Hello, I'm Kara Parks.
Mechanical
engineering. Good afternoon. So I guess we'll start it off. Could you tell our audience a little bit about how United Launch Alliance was started and how you first got involved with the company?
Oh, sure. So the United Launch Alliance was formed in 2006. And prior to that, Boeing and Lockheed Martin had been flying two separate and competing launch vehicle families, the Atlas V and the Delta IV family. And the industry had sort of anticipated what was forecast at that time to be a gigantic market in space-based telecommunications. We thought, and the government thought and projected, there would be over 50 launches a year just to support that market. Unfortunately, fiber on the ground and cell sort of beat them to the marketplace, and that space-based telecommunications market never really happened. And so that 50 launches a year never happened. And at that point, we really had too much space lift capacity for what was demanded, which still remained at that time to be primarily national security space. So things like GPS satellites and communication satellites, things like that. And so Boeing and Lockheed, at the sort of encouragement of the government, set up a joint venture, so a separate company that was owned by the two parent companies. And they took over those two rocket families. That became the United Launch Alliance, and that's the company that we have today. Now, I've been building rockets my whole career, about 30 years, with Lockheed Martin. And about last summer, I was asked to come over and replace the CEO of ULA, and I came on board about the middle of August.
Awesome. And I think it's safe to say now that, just give our audience a little bit of a bigger view about ULA, they're now, I think it would be safe to say that you're the largest provider of space lift capabilities in the world. You operate the Atlas V, the Delta IV, and the Delta II launch vehicles currently. And, you know, your only rivals maybe Roscosmos.
Yes, that's true. We are the world's premier heavy lift provider. We put up the majority of our government satellites. We've put up nearly all of the NASA science missions that involve the really large payloads, and of course most of the payloads for the NOAA, for the Weather Service, so that, you know, the weather satellites. So we sort of touch your life every day. So if you've ever used your GPS to go somewhere, you know, we really helped you arrive. We put up all of those spacecraft. If you check the weather this morning, you know, the weather satellites that made that possible were put up there by the United Launch Alliance. And so, yes, we are. We operate a fleet of 16 different rockets, 10 within the Atlas family, another 4 in Delta. And as you pointed out, we are still flying the Delta II.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I went to a recent ULA recruitment session at the University of Alabama, and they were talking about how ULA is unveiling a new rocket very soon.
Yes, we are.
So
at the Space Symposium in April, however many days it is between now and, I believe, April 13th, we are going to reveal our next generation of space launch system. So a new rocket and a new family of rockets.
So I think the big question is, and I don't know if you're at liberty to reveal this, but you know, one thing that a lot of the people talking to different engineers here were wondering about, with this new launch vehicle family, will there be any capability to perhaps combat SpaceX's reusable drive that they're making?
So I'm not going to give you any big spoilers, but I'll give you some hints.
We'll take it.
The new rocket is going to be much less expensive. It's going to have significantly more capability than the rocket families we have today. So even more lift than the Delta Heavy, the biggest rocket flying. And we have a concept we call smart reusability that really solves this from a systems engineering point of view to get at what is really an economics problem. For the launch rates we're talking about, you know, it's not the engineering challenge of doing reusability that's really important. It's the economics of making it cost effective. Now, there will come a day when we're flying up and back, you know, every single day, two times a day. And when that day comes, reusability will be an imperative because it won't be practical to build expendables. But for the next several years, it's really about how to make space lift less expensive and more accessible. So I will be talking about reusability out in April at the Space Symposium, but I'm not going to tell you exactly what it is. I'm going to make you wait.
Has the name for the new rocket been decided on yet?
No. And Kara, you get to help us do that. So in just a few days, we're going to open up, since it's America's ride to space and it's America's next rocket, I thought it would be cool to let America name it. So we are going to open up a naming contest, and you can dial up and vote and go to our website and vote and help us pick the name.
That's neat. I have a couple suggestions already. Cool.
Well, it's not too late to try. So, you know, we're going to give you a short list to vote from. Mm-hmm. And once we get to that point, there's no write-ins. But it's not too late to give me suggestions to try and make the short list.
Cool.
Oh, that would be really neat.
I would like to point out
but,
that we're...
I know...
Oh, go ahead, Kara.
I'm sorry. Okay. I just wanted to ask you, when I was talking to Mr. Langford, who came to the campus, he said that you have a really cool story about some of the rockets you made as a kid.
Uh-oh. So Craig's been telling that story, huh? So,
well,
yeah.
He said he would let you tell it, but he told me that I should ask.
Okay, well, I'm happy to tell you the story. So it kind of started with, you know, building rockets my whole life, and I literally mean that. I built my first rockets when I was 12. And, you know, actually a lot of kids do that. But the smart kids, you know, they went and they got their parents to buy them, you know, the Estes rocket kits, and they built their first rockets that way. I was not one of those smart kids. I found this case of just moldy old 80-year-old dynamite in the back of my grandmother's barn. And, you know, being 12 years old, I didn't know how dangerous it was. I certainly didn't understand why it was all wet. And, of course, now, you know, years later, I learned that, well, you know, wet dynamite means the nitroglycerin just sweated out onto the surface. But I didn't know any of that, so I took my penknife and I cut open the sticks and pulled out the powder and the paper, and I packed my own solid rocket motors and built my own rockets. And I'm very proud to say that some of them got at least 100 feet off the pad before they exploded. Even more important than that is I still got all 10 of my fingers.
Wow, that's that's one way to get into the industry.
Well, I like to think that I was spared.
I was thinking
that I could be here with you today.
So moving past that a little bit, I guess this actually gives us an opportunity to talk about your career a little bit. I'm reading here that, you know, you, of course, you said before the ULA, you were with Lockheed Martin, and one of your big projects was THAAD, which is the Terminal High Area Altitude Defense System, which is kind of the replacement to the Patriot missile defense system that is in use by the Army today. And I think THAAD's actually been, a couple THAAD units have been shipped to the Army, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, basically they're designed to strike down nuclear missiles for the audience. So did you want to talk a little bit about working in that program?
Sure. Well, I really enjoyed working on THAAD. You know, there's nothing like working on these very high-performance rockets and rockets that do a mission that's so very, very important. You know, missile defense in general is becoming more important every day as, you know, folks who are less friendly around the globe get capabilities to harm people, And these kind of missile defense systems are just absolutely essential. Now, THAAD was great. I mean, THAAD, you're correct, it is now in production. It's a couple of batteries have been delivered to the Army. There's a battery deployed out in Guam, you know, protecting folks out there right now. And, of course, the technology on THAAD was absolutely amazing. It's a relatively small rocket. You know, it's about the length of a pickup truck, and it's a single-stage solid booster, but it's a real hot rod. You know, when you launch a THAAD, it goes from 0 to 60 miles an hour within its own length. And less than half a minute later, it is traveling faster than a 30-06 round. And then it drops off that expended booster, and it continues on with what's called the kill vehicle. That's, you know, the part of the missile that has a sensor on it that can find that incoming attacking missile, and then it literally steers itself in front of it. It's got an infrared sensor on the front. It could see an ice cube at a mile in the sky, and it has thrusters that allow it to shift its trajectory, and it literally runs into the incoming warhead. It doesn't have any ordnance on it. It destroys it entirely with kinetic energy. And the required accuracy of this collision, which the closing velocities now are like 4 to 5 times the speed of a rifle round, is something about the size of a dinner plate. So you literally put a single point on that kill vehicle. There's literally a fastener right there, and you pass it through that target that you've selected on that incoming warhead in order to destroy it. The actual accuracy is much better. In fact, it's so much better, you wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Yeah, I think the thing that fascinates me about it is watching them launch that nice corkscrew that they take off to bleed off their it's actually, if I remember correctly, it's to bleed velocity because they come out of the tubes too hot to acquire, so they have to corkscrew on their way up. That's just cool to me. I'm one of those rocket guys, so that's just, hey, let's, you know, make something ridiculous and let's go make it blow up another rocket. That's
yes, that's the THAAD energy management maneuver, and it was really put in place because we started our first testing at the White Sands Missile Range out in New Mexico, which is a gigantic place, but for THAAD, which can fly out, you know, hundreds of miles to intercept an attacking, missile, it was actually a little bit too small. And for range safety purposes, you've got it exactly. We come out of the canister and then basically fly around in circles a few times, and bleed off energy, and then off we go.
Yeah, wow. I mean, speaking of these, all these different launches, and taking it back a little bit to ULA, you guys have a really, really good track record with your launches. And what kind of things do you attribute to ULA's success with all these launches?
Yes, we do have a good record. We're very proud of that. We're now at 94 launches, and all 94 have been successful, and all 94 have been on time. And so I attribute that to several things. You know, the first is, of course, you know, it is a mature design, these families of rockets that we fly. But our people have such dedication to these missions, and they have such deep experience at building rockets. They bring all that with just an incredible attention to detail. And we like to say, you know, we've flown 94 one at a time. And Kara, you know, you said you went to a recruiting event. I would love to see you at ULA sometime soon. And if you were there, you would hear that we never use the word consecutive, because it's not 94 consecutive, because every launch is unique, and every launch has to have that level of discipline and process and experience applied in order to have that kind of success record.
So since you brought that up, I think I'll go ahead and ask the question. You know, being a university radio show, we were wondering, you know, looking at an aerospace engineering student or a mechanical engineering student for that matter, or, you know, even electrical from here at the university, or, you know, those that happen to host radio shows, what would you look for in a candidate at ULA?
Well, there's probably three things that are most important to me. So the first thing is I want to see people that have a real passion for this kind of work and care deeply about the missions that we support. Because when our folks come to work every day, you know, they're building rockets, which is fun and it's glamorous and it's cool, but it's more than that. They're saving lives. They're helping us to explore the universe, and they're really tying the world together and connecting it in ways that only space can do. That's what we really do every day. So the first and most important thing is people that have a passion for that and really care deeply about these missions. The next thing I look for is folks who are really sort of self-initiated and really want to get in there and make a difference. They don't just sit back and wait to be told what to do. They're always looking for how to do the work better and to, you know, advance the technology and really sort of take us to the next level. And then, of course, we look for creative people who can help us bring a lot of innovation to it. You know, as you talked about earlier in the show, we're embarking on a new, you know, next generation family of launch vehicles. That development is underway now. And so we're going to bring some really exciting innovations to the world of Lyft. And I'm looking for people that just have a real desire to do that. So those are probably the first, you know, the most important things.
Yeah, as they should be. Now, I'm kind of just curious, have you had a favorite or most memorable launch at ULA that you've watched or been a part of? Or both?
I do. Yeah. I often get asked what's my favorite rocket, and I always say I can't tell because I don't want to make the other rockets feel bad. I will admit to so far having a favorite launch and you know, my apologies to everybody else, but, you know, the Orion launch that we did at the end of last year, you know, which is this, you know, first, you know, return to space and these really this first bold few steps at you know, seeking our human destiny beyond this planet, where we put that capsule up and out past the Van Allen belts and brought it back in. That was just really incredible. I loved every minute of that launch.
That's awesome. And that brings us actually to another thing. ULA, you mentioned doing manned missions in the future. What kind of manned missions do you think ULA will be involved with?
Well, the very first one will be taking astronauts to the International Space Station. So Boeing's commercial crew mission for NASA that will fly the Boeing CST-100 space capsule will be on top of an Atlas. And so those flights start happening in 17, and then they continue on for several years. And then, of course, we will be the interim upper stage on the Space Launch System, which is NASA's, you know, future gigantic back to the moon and beyond rocket. So we'll be involved with that on the front part of that program, and then we'll see what happens after that. So, you know, I foresee a time when we're, you know, going to see a lot of not just commercialization of space the way we see it now in telecommunications and Earth observation, but actual commercialization of human spaceflight. And there are people out there that I think have some really intriguing ideas and some great vision for that. And the ULA is going to be a part of that. We're going to help them and provide their ride.
And actually, this is rather timely. I think it was 4 or 5 days ago, Lockheed Martin announced plans to provide ISS cargo unmanned. What they came out with was very similar to a European ATV module. And they're using, I believe they specified that they were going to use ULA Atlas V, didn't they?
Yes, they talked about the Atlas V. So I think you're referring to the Jupiter space tug.
Yes.
A few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what a great and kind of exciting piece of technology. You know, on the surface, you think, oh, you know, it's a robotic tug. You know, that doesn't sound glamorous, but it actually is. Because if you're going to go and live and work in space every day and you know, and build habitats and have routine operations, the things that you would experience if people were really living in space, you got to have a space tug. You got to have transportation. You've got to have all of that type of infrastructure. And to see Lockheed Martin come out with that concept and that plan to develop it and deploy it is just the first step of all of that. And so I thought that was really exciting. And I know the fellow who's in charge of that program and that part of the business over there, and he's, I can't tell you how excited he is to go do that. and I'm thrilled to go work with him on it.
Now, is that a I'm looking at it right now, but I actually can't find the answer to this. It's a polar vehicle, isn't it? As in the engines would be forward of the cargo. Essentially, it is literally a tug. It pulls its cargo through space. That's that's really interesting because I think we've talked about that concept on this show before, where, you know, if we look further down the line, I've talked to friends that work at Lockheed, actually, they're working on Orion now, that, you know, say, when we eventually get to the time where it's time to build this train to go to Mars, you know, it makes more sense to pull the vehicle than it does to push the vehicle, because when you put a bunch of parts together, things start to get bendy if you don't have strong enough docking rigidity. So, you know, having the idea of a polar vehicle come out, that's really cool.
Yeah, well,
it is. And, you know, if we're going back and forth on a routine basis to Mars, the Moon, or to asteroids, there will need to be infrastructure. There will be fuel depots. There will be tugs. There will be way stations. It's going to be completely different than the way we go to space today.
Well, and speaking of all these future plans and stuff for space, where do you see the industry being in about 10 years or so? What kind of progress do you think we'll have achieved by then?
Sure. Well, in 10 years, I think there will be two new and very exciting things. First, I think we will begin to see real utility in small and micro satellites. And so we won't just be lifting, you know, the big satellites we do now, but we'll be taking up perhaps whole planes at one time on an Atlas launch vehicle, and it will create an accessibility that will stimulate different missions and different uses for space. And we'll see a lot of the information highway, a lot of the internet move out to space, and that will allow us to have different uses. So that'll be the first thing, miniaturization of satellites that have actual utility. The second thing is I think we'll begin seeing just the first piece of that commercialization of human space flight. So we will see privately constructed habitats in things like that just in that 10-year window.
You know, I think that's something we've talked about here too, is that, you know, we're trying to start a CubeSat team here at the university, and you know, one thing about these CubeSats is that, you know, I'm a freshman now, I probably won't see a thing launch before I graduate. I might see it in my first year of my graduate study. And it's mainly because these launch vehicles are immensely expensive. It's immensely expensive to take even a 10-centimeter cube and stick it into orbit. That's an immense amount of money, and not only that, we have this crazy idea where we want to stick a propulsion system on the bottom of it, so we're out of our minds anyway. But, you know, with the ULA's new launch vehicles and, you know, you talking about, let's get this launch cost down, do you see one day where, you know, even in the student realm, students will have ready access to, you know, we have this CubeSat that we worked really hard on, but we want to get it up in 2 years instead of five?
Right.
Yes, I do, but, you know, what I really want to do, in advance of, you know, rockets being so cheap that you know, students could get together and buy one, I would rather look at our excess capability. So, you know, I talked about having a family of launch vehicles, and we do that so that we can effectively service small satellites, big satellites, satellites that are interplanetary, spacecraft that are interplanetary. And so what you end up with within the family is discrete points of capability. Right, it's not a continuum. And so on any given mission, if you're not completely stressing that rocket model's capability, if you're flying at all just sort of underneath that, but not so far under that you would drop to the next lowest model, there's excess capability. And so you can take along sort of ride shares or ride-alongs really for no significant additional cost, because there's somebody else who's already bought that rocket and they have a primary mission, and then these CubeSats could be secondary missions. So our team is looking right now at how we can expand the availability of those kinds of, you know, essentially free rides or low-cost rides to student organizations so that you would not have to wait, you know, until you had enough to, you know, justify, a major effort or a major expense to get a launch. And I'm not going to say any more because we don't quite have it worked out yet, and I'm already giving out kind of spoilers on something we'll talk about later in the year. But look to that happening Big announcement sometime later this year about how we're going to make it easier for students to get to space as well.
Wow, that would be fantastic. Now, what kind of new technologies do you see coming out that you're really excited about integrating as space technologies?
So technologies in space or technologies on the rocket?
Just technologies that are in development currently that you can apply to your rockets or to any of the onboard pieces of the rocket.
Sure. Well, there's a couple of things. You know, the first thing that I'm sort of excited about is the new replacement American rocket engine we're developing with a couple of partners to replace our Russian RD-180 that we use on the Atlas. So the RD-180 was a rocket engine that we brought under the Atlas just before ULA was formed because the government called us up and said, hey, you know, the Cold War's over and we don't want these Russian rocket scientists ending up in places like North Korea if they got any interesting technology that you would use. And as it turned out, you know, the RD-180 had a sort of an advanced combustion technology that we did not have in the United States at the time. And so we brought it in. Now, interestingly enough, outside the RD-180, which is still manufactured over there in Russia until I replace it, is the only place that that technology comes here. American rockets still do not have this advanced, what we call staged, oxygen-rich staged combustion technology. So when we develop our new rocket engine, we're going to be bringing that into America, and we're going to take that technology to the next step and advance it further. So it's a much higher performance, much lighter weight, and much smaller rocket engine than anything that is currently flying in the U.S. apart from the RD-180 that I have under the Atlas. Now, in addition to that, additive manufacturing is about to create a whole revolution in the way we design and in the way we fabricate rockets. There's going to be additive manufacturing in that rocket engine, but there's also going to be additive manufacturing throughout the new rocket. So we're going through right now and understanding essentially which pieces of the design are suitable for that, and we're practicing today on Atlas and Delta by manufacturing tooling and support equipment and even just a couple of items, you know, for flight, so that we'll be ready when the new rocket comes along to be able to bring all that technology in there in a much bigger way. So I'd say those are the two most exciting things to me right now.
And for those that were wondering, additive manufacturing is actually 3D printing, which is something that we talk about a lot on the show because we do a whole lot of it. And, you know, that's actually really exciting to me. I was at the USA Science and Engineering Festival last year that Lockheed Martin puts on in Washington, D.C. Biannually. And they were actually 3D printing nose cones out on the show floor. They had a robotic arm with an extruder on the end that was sitting there printing nose cones to satellites on the floor. So,
yeah, how cool was that?
That's really cool.
Yeah, you know, certainly interesting. The more we work with it, the more we learn about it. It's just a fascinating technology. And like any new thing, you know, some of what it can do is counterintuitive. You wouldn't guess that, you know. So if I'll tell you, for example, you know, we fly cameras on the rocket, and the cameras have sort of little miniature fairings to protect them because, you know, the rocket on the way up, you know, it looks on the pad, you know, sort of rising up majestically, you know, and slowly into the sky. But that's only because it's so gigantic. I mean, you guys know that it is really moving fast. And within just a couple of minutes, you know, a large rocket like an Atlas 551 will have gone from, you know, rest to 30,000 miles an hour. And so it is really cooking. And the environment that is on the outside skin of the rocket is very hot. There's tremendous aeroheating and at some points plasma as we roll, you know, into hypersonic velocity. So we have these little fairings that are to protect the cameras. And you might not think that would be a good application for 3D printing or additive manufacturing. Certainly not in polymers anyway. You might think, well, the titanium applications might, but surprisingly enough, depending on how you design it and configure it with the degree of fill, the additive manufactured parts can make very good ablative heat shields. And so that's just one of the new things we've discovered as we begin working with them. So I think there's, you know, just a revolution coming in that.
Definitely, and I think actually it was another thing that happened a few days ago. They actually, some scientists debuted a technique of 3D printing that uses a UV curable resin to essentially, instead of adding from above and using an extruder, and now literally if you look at it, it pulls it out of a pool of resin, and that's fascinating, and that's essentially the Star Trek replicator, so the future is now. But, you know, the possibilities of that in the future, now that we can do it 100 times faster than we can do it with extruders, you know, that's, we're getting to the point where we can literally make anything out of our imagination almost instantly.
Yes, I saw that. That was very cool. And, you know, the next step as engineering students, you know, will be the way it changes how you design. So right now it's all about changing how we manufacture and how we can make things quicker and do prototyping and make things much less expensive. But, you know, you don't have to use necessarily the same materials, you know, when you're fabricating a part. So there will be a day when you'll, instead of saying, well, I'm going to make it thicker here because the stresses are higher here, you'll simply change the material properties. Or instead of making an assembly because this is a structural cone and I need a radome on top, you know, for radar transparency, no, I'll just change the material as I transition through there. It's going to change the way we design as well as the way we manufacture.
Definitely, and I think it even changes the way we test. That's something Kara and I can both attest to on design teams that we're working with here at the university. You know, we have something that we want to test in a wind tunnel. Instead of making, you know, a full one out of foam curing like we're planning to do for the final product, we're like, well, let's just 3D print one. And, you know, we can correct for the materials differences in mass. So, you know, 36 hours later, here's our test bed.
Right.
Yes, it's absolutely
Yeah. Well, and I mean, to being able to do 3D printing and additive manufacturing has less limits on how you can design, because the manufacturing process for all these things usually have to be a certain way, and some things aren't actually possible for people to manufacture. But with having 3D printings and additive manufacturing, it makes it a lot easier to go further out and to expand the amount of things that you can do. But that being said, what kind of things do you think, what kind of achievements do you think ULA will reach in the future with these new developments in technology?
Well, we're just going to make space so much more accessible than it is now. This next generation of rocket is going to be so flexible and have so much more capacity that it can lift at a much, much lower cost. In addition to that, we're going to change the way that, you know, our customers buy from us. It's going to be just a revolution in how they do that. You know, today, a customer comes to you and they have a big book of requirements and your big staff of engineers and theirs sit together and you sort of build this, you know, this rocket in this configuration up from scratch. And it takes a long time. And if they end up at the end of the day at a place they're not quite comfortable with, it's very difficult to go backwards, and then they have to do that well in advance of when you would want to launch. You know, it's not unusual for customers to order a launch 2, 3, even 4 years out. We're going to change all of that. You know, they're going to literally be able to sort of build their own rocket. You know, it'll be like when you go to the a car website and build your own car. There'll be a standard rocket there, and they can add options to it and do their own trades and arrive at their own best value sort of affordability before they even call us to sort of finish it off. And we're going to do things that make it possible to come within just, you know, just a couple of months, a handful of months in advance of a launch and have them walk up to us and say, you know, I need to launch this rocket in 2 or 3 months. Can you do that? And we'd say, sure. When today, that's 10 times faster than you would have to get in line to launch your rocket. So all of that is going to make space a lot more accessible. And then when we get to space with this rocket, what it can do will be much more flexible. So one of the things that ULA has across its family of rockets that's unique is our high-energy upper stage. So, you know, when you're going to the most difficult orbits, you know, geosynchronous orbit, these highly elliptical orbits, or even interplanetary with very large bodies, very, you know, payloads that are very heavy, It takes a tremendous amount of energy, and you can sort of think of it in three parts. You know, the big core booster's getting you up out of the gravity well, and let's say you're going to geosynchronous orbit. First, you kind of go to a transfer orbit, which has the right altitude, but it's, you know, it's highly elliptical, and then you have to spend an enormous amount of energy to circularize it. That's what that last high-energy stage does, and it involves a lot of impulse in periods where you turn it off and you coast and then you turn it on again and you cycle through that to sort of round it out. The high-energy upper stages that we have are the most advanced in the world, but they only operate about 7 or 8 hours, which is more than enough for the kind of missions you envision today. But the future systems we're going to put up will have even more energy and even more tremendous amounts of flexibility. We're going to be talking about days of on-orbit operations. So you could go to one plane, you could go to another plane, you could do complex operations at the space station or some other commercial habitat. So all of that is going to really change how people use space, and there will be missions that we can't even think of today as a result of that.
Wow, that'll be a sight to see for sure.
Are you thinking of moving into, you say these, we want the system that can, possibly change multiple planes while it's in orbit and stuff like that. Now, my conventional thinking of that is, all right, we're going to have this, a liquid-fueled tank up there, and we're going to have a conventional rocket motor at the bottom. That, normally, just because of weight requirements with your launch vehicle, you usually don't get that much delta-V, as we call it in the industry, of fuel out of it. And one answer that we hear, a lot around here from professors and stuff like that is, well, let's just put, let's just go nuclear with it. Is that a thought that the ULA has? I know that there's the UN ban on, nuclear power devices in space, but...
Yeah, so every once in a while someone will ask me, what comes after chemical propulsion? And I'm afraid I always say what it sounds like your professors say. I think the very next technology will be, clean nuclear propulsion. But I'm going to be honest with you and tell you that in my judgment, that's quite a ways off. Chemical will be the way we get this done for many years to come still.
Yeah. Now, just something kind of that I'm curious about. What is it like for you on launch day? Can you sort of take us through how that I feel like it's hard to imagine for people who are not involved in a launch or just, they watch it on TV once in a while or that kind of thing. But how is it for the actual people there working and all that background stuff?
Yeah. Well, it's the culmination of years of hard work, not just for us, but for our customers. So it's, it's an exciting time. And as you're coming up into launch day, it really starts about 3 days ahead, being a very intense effort. But the thing that I think people who aren't involved don't also appreciate is what it means to those who are involved. And so when you're sitting there, finally at the, in the last several hours and you're in the control center and typically, your customer is there as well. And let's say it's a, it's a NASA science mission. And so the principal investigator who has the theory that is about to be verified and probably spent their entire life, on that body of work and helped in the design of the spacecraft so that it could finally verify that or go collect that missing piece of data that will unlock that mystery, they're there too. And you're looking over at that person and realizing that scientist probably spent 25, 30 years coming to this one moment in time. And they may not have another 30 years. This is it. This is where they are. And their whole life's work has come to that. And if it's not a principal investigator, maybe it's someone from the Air Force, and you're putting up a critical asset that's going to save people's lives, and you have the tremendous weight of that responsibility on you. Then you've got all of the work that your team is doing. They're out there preparing the rocket, going through our process, which is very structured. And as I alluded to at the beginning, when you asked me, why do you get 94 in a row? Well, it's a tremendous amount of experience translated into the disciplined process as we execute in those last many hours. And so they, you know, people have been up all night, they've been working in shifts, and then finally I'm there, you know, I'm down in the control room, and the team is there, they're all doing their job, and I'm trying to look very confident and tell them what a good job they're doing, and, you know, just, you know, do what you know how to do, and stay on your console, and, you know, be the good engineer and rocket scientist we know you are, and we try and look very calm. But I'll tell you what, I have participated now over the years in over 300 rocket launches, and it's the same every time. I mean, you are biting your nails, because even though you're, you know, say at ULA and you have this great record of 94 in a row, no one's ever done anything like that, you still know that that rocket is a incredibly complex, powerful, and unforgiving machine. And everything on it has to work exactly right. And if any little thing goes wrong, it's 1 million or 2 million pounds of propellant just waiting to get out of control. And so it is still nerve-wracking and intense and exciting. And when that thing finally lights off, and it just rises up into the sky on that pillar of fire, there is no feeling like that in the world.
Would you say that that's one of the best things about working for ULA?
Absolutely. There's nothing like launch day in the moment when that sucker goes off. So exciting.
So, Mr. Bruno, you've been busy getting onto social media sites like Twitter, and you just had a Reddit forum with a whole bunch of people. How are you working to help build the image of ULA? Because a lot of people, I mean, some people they'll know about maybe Virgin Galactic or SpaceX, but ULA is not quite on people's radar yet. So how are you working to change that?
Well, by doing the things you talked about, you know, and isn't that ironic that the world's premier launch provider, the company with the largest fleet of rockets that has put up most of the spacecraft orbiting the Earth today, is the one company that no one's heard of. And so, you know, as we talked about before, you know, wanting to make space so much more accessible, I think about this in the same way, because space touches our lives every single day. And so I really want to make the industry that makes that possible also accessible. And so I thought social media would just be a sort of a tremendous way to reach out and actually connect with people. And so when I go, you know, when I go on Twitter, and certainly obviously when I did the, you know, the AMA on Reddit, it's really me. It's not, you know, it's not my, you know, external communication staff, you know, it's not a PR person. It's just me. And so if I say something foolish, I'm sorry. And I will talk to anyone who comes on there. You know, if somebody has a question, I'll answer it. If they, you know, want to give me suggestions, I probably picked up 50, 60 name ideas for the new rocket off of Twitter. People shared those with me, and we put them in the hopper. So it's just a way of making, you know, the ULA not just better known, but also, you know, better understood, and really kind of putting a face on it so that people can reach out and connect with someone and actually have a conversation.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. That's kind of, you know, now ULA has that going for them with, you know, you, of course, and that's what SpaceX kind of always had going for them with Elon Musk. But, you know, looking at this industry, we sit down and look at it and we're like, you know, NASA, everyone knows who they are because they're NASA, but they're not very good at PR. Yeah, at the end of the day, they're PAO. They do great work at the PAO. They're just not good at nailing it like, you know, SpaceX is, or now the ULA is. I think ULA is probably, you guys are probably the best at PR out of any of the companies out there right now.
Wow, well, thank you. Jessica is so flattered.
And, you know, I also absolutely agree with you on the sense that, you know, this is why we started this program. I mean, this program is dedicated to all varieties of engineering, but a good amount of it is spaceflight, and it's simply because we want to get the awareness out, both what's going on at the university and in the world with, you know, what the ULA is doing. Because people just don't know. I think when I pitched this program, I think I referred to it as, you know, the engineering college over there, it's like Hogwarts. Nobody knows what we're doing. The rest of this campus has no idea who we are. So,
well, and spaceflight technologies, they're such on the edge and the new, like, as you discussed, there's a lot of things that they touch in our lives that people don't realize. So it's really fantastic to get out and to talk to people about what ULA and other people are working on as far as all these, the satellites and the manned missions and all the exciting things that are to come. It's just, it'll be, it's a really good thing to reach out, and it'll expand ULA and their I guess, recognition from the common person quite a bit.
Well, I hope so, because, you know, space is so important to all our lives.
Definitely. And, you know, I think especially with the expanding future that there's, you know, there's not a better time for anyone to be in the business. Be it, you know, us or, you know, you guys over at ULA or anything. You know, the spaceflight industry is booming so much right now, now that we're looking at, you know, let's get out there and go to Mars, you know, shuttle's over. And, you know, as much as all of us love the shuttle, it's time to look towards Mars, the asteroids, you know, actually commercializing the area around low Earth orbit. I think it's the most exciting time and probably the best time to be in the spaceflight industry. We're kind of taking that first step. Out past, you know, we're taking the first step since Apollo, and we're kind of taking the first step to truly making humanity a spacefaring civilization.
Well, Matthew, I agree completely, and I love your vision. You know, I'll just say that Mars is just one destination.
Yeah, I mean, I would totally agree with you. You know, we're looking, you know, what's past Mars? There's plenty of moons out there. There's moons, of, you know, there's tons of excitement about, you know, what's happening on Ceres right now. What are those two bright spots? Or even looking out to Jupiter and seeing these moons, you know, well, do they have liquid oceans under them? And what could we do with that if we get there? And then, of course, you know, they say the first person to mine an asteroid is going to be the first trillionaire.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I
for you too.
And
first trillionaires.
Yeah, definitely. I hope so.
Well, that would be nice.
Yeah, it would be nice. And you know, I think I'll go ahead and ask our wrap up question here, since we can go ahead and insert a break once we get to the real show and make this a nice hour segment. But you know, I wanted to ask a little bit. I do actually have a history minor, so I'm a pretty big historian too, and I worked in the history industry when I was in high school. I noticed that you were the author of several books that specifically have to do around with the Knights Templar, and you are also a recipient of the Order of Merit of the Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem. So, you know, that's pretty cool. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you got involved with that?
Well, I'm flattered that you even know that. So, you know, everyone has a hobby, and like you, I love history. And that was my hobby. And, you know, when you discover the Crusades, they're such an exciting thing to read about and learn about. You know, it's more dramatic than any Hollywood movie ever made about them. You know, there's greed and there's zealots and there's idealists and there's just the full spectrum of human emotion, human nobility, and human vice all wrapped up into that era of history. And so I just loved it. And I was fascinated at one point by the notion of how the Templars operated essentially as not just this military organization, but really as a gigantic corporation that raised the resources for that military mission, you know, in the Holy Land. And so that's really what the books sort of take a look at and examine. And, you know, it's if you're not, really into history, then they're also very useful because, if you're suffering from insomnia, you know, it'll put you right up.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look for a copy of them because they sound fascinating to me.
Do you ever feel that
if you, Matthew, if you call my office and give my admin your address, I will send you a signed copy.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you very much. And, you know, I was also about to bring up, it was actually my very first history professor that I had here at the university. When I talked to him about being a minor for the first time, because I hadn't declared my history minor yet, and I told him my major was in aerospace, he was like, give me a favor and go to your course packet and read the very last entry in your course packet. So I did, and I went back there, and it was actually the CEO of Northrop Grumman. And, he has this long article where before that, he had been the undersecretary of the Army and all this other stuff. And basically his argument was, I employ 30,000 engineers, and I wish they would think like historians. Because, I might be playing my own horn a little bit here, but, you know, historians do have that critical thinking aspect to them. And, you know, I hear that that's well-liked in the engineering world.
I think it is. What a great quote.
Well, and perhaps, I mean, history always has a lot to teach us about the future. So as far as all of the new things that we do with technology, we always have to be cautious and remember the lessons that we've learned. Do you feel that any of the things that have happened in history are kind of lessons for what we should make sure that we do when we get into space, when humans are establishing new settlements in space and that general realm?
Well, I think that's a great perspective, Kara, because, you know, since we haven't had, you know, an extensive presence in space, we tend to think of it as somehow an inherently egalitarian and peaceful place that when we get there, it'll be that way. Well, it's that way now because we're not there. And when people go there, we will bring all of the politics and strife and competition that exists here on Earth unless we think about how we want it to be and can take steps to bring that future into reality.
Yeah, I would totally agree. I think, you know, I would sum it up a little bit as, you know, the thing that really one of my great fascinations with history is the colonial era when we're, you know, first going out, we're looking at the voyages of Magellan and Cook and even Columbus to an extent, even though, you know, that's a huge debate within the academic realm. But, you know, I talked to Apollo 7's Walter Cunningham about it too, and, you know, we look at it today where we get afraid that, you know, we're sending 100 people to Mars and they might not come back. When the colonists went to Jamestown, there was no idea that they were ever going back to England. Their job was to die in Virginia. So, you know, live their lives and die in Virginia. But you were establishing a colony. You weren't going back. It was that detachment and that step into the unknown that they took that now, you know, at least in Walter Cunningham's opinion, and I'm inclined to agree with him, that not us, but general society is getting a little bit risk adverse, where they're just not liking that idea of, well, we have to take a chance.
We have to stick our neck out, as Walter Cunningham. We have to try new things.
Space is hard. Space is so difficult. It's probably the most challenging of all human endeavors. You know, Mother Nature puts tremendous obstacles for us leaving this planet. There are risks. And the NASA director, Charlie Bolden, he talks about this all the time. If we're going to do something this difficult, this challenging, this aspirational as a race, there absolutely will be risks, and we must have the courage to be able to face those.
Definitely. Kara, do you have any concluding questions? Or?
Well, let me just check real quick. No, basically, Mr. Bruno, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and maybe some other time we can have you on again, maybe to talk about some new, exciting, successful mission that you had. But do you have any closing thoughts or advice you'd like to leave us or our audience with?
Well, I just had one last thing I wanted to say.
Okay.
And that was Roll Tide.
Roll Tide. Great.
Roll Tide, Mr. Bruno.
All right. Well, that concludes the recording. Mr. Bruno, on behalf of us and the university, thank you very much for speaking to us. And, you know, it was a great interview. I'll definitely be taking you up on that book offer, and I'll be sending my resume into the ULA tonight. So
that was
awesome.
Yeah, I'll definitely be checking the postings again.
Yeah.
But, well,
it's my pleasure.
So
I look forward to seeing or talking with both of you again sometime.
Definitely. Yeah, we'll definitely be in touch. And, you know, maybe one day I'll either be working for you or I'll come see you out in Denver.
That would be great.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye. Roll Tide.